Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, October 18th. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio is WCAI's lead reporter, Sarah Mises-Tan. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
And from the Cape Cod Times, we have with us Kristen Young. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Joining us later will be Noah Asmo from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We'll check in with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. And now a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the islands. For the second week in a row, we caught a walloping storm across the region, this one with very strong wind gusts that knocked out power. Many folks still without it this morning, looking at about 17,000 homes and businesses without power across the Cape and South Coast region. This all started Wednesday night, Kristen, with some very strong wind gusts.
Yes, yeah, so this was a storm that, it tossed boats ashore, it disrupted ferry service, and it led to power outages to as many as 45,000 Barnstable County customers at the height of it. Schools in two of the hardest hit towns in Falmouth and Barnstable were closed because of impassable trees, and these wind gusts were really strong. The highest gusts occurred in Provincetown, with one at 83 miles per hour just before 2 a.m., and that was followed by another blast of about 90 miles per hour 21 minutes later. Wind gusts of 78 miles per hour and 72 miles per hour reported in Mashpee and Harwich. And those are really strong winds considering a storm is considered to be hurricane force when it reaches sustained winds of 74 miles per hour.
Sarah, you were out driving around yesterday doing some reporting, and it seemed that the damage was fairly localized. While much of the Cape caught these heavy winds, some areas received more damage than others.
Yeah, definitely. I was actually surprised. I had to go out to Mashpee early morning yesterday for an unrelated interview and basically had no issues getting out there along Route 151 and was kind of spared some of the real damage until I headed back into the station later in the day, where it really became clear that Falmouth and Woods Hole were really one of the epicenters of where the storm hit. There were lots of debris on the road as I got closer to Falmouth and lots of downed power lines and trees.
At one point, the access to Woods Hole was all but closed. It seemed like it was very difficult for folks to get down to Woods Hole because of the damage, the trees down. There's just a couple of roads that lead down to this end of the Cape. And you had an interview lined up with somebody around noon who was going to come down to the station from Falmouth. It took them an enormous amount of time to get down here.
Yeah, traffic was being rerouted around to Surf Drive. And even then, I think they were opening and closing different roads depending on when you were going by to clear trees and all that. And so someone was trying to get down here. And because of all the roads that were opening and closing at different intervals, just hit some bad luck.
It took
about 40 minutes.
40 minutes to get from Falmouth to Woods Hole, which, if you don't know, is maybe a 7-minute drive or something like that. So
yeah.
The indication of how complicated things got as the trees came down and blocked roads here. What can you tell us, Kristen, about how the storm response has gone?
Well, I think, you know, people were trying to get out there and respond. I know DPW crews across the Cape were kind of getting out in their own towns and responding to those localized, as you said, areas where trees had come down and blocked power lines, that sort of thing. There was really a problem, though, getting power up and going again because of those continuing winds that really lasted throughout the day on Thursday. And really what happened was there's that need to clear those downed trees and wires before utility crews can get in there and fix things. There are some out-of-state utility crews, though, that were expected to arrive today to help with the effort.
As we're recording this, a little after 9 in the morning on Friday, still no power in Woods Hole. Some upside to the story, Woods Hole Market yesterday was giving away free ice cream as their freezers were, they had no power for their freezers. My kids, who had no school because the schools were closed, were very happy about the free ice cream that was being given out here. We have a sense that power might be back on when?
Eversource is saying power should be fully restored to the Cape by 8 p.m. on Saturday. And so, you know, we're looking at a little bit longer, but hopefully it won't take quite that long for Woods Hole.
One of the big stories this week, we're going to move on here, the long-awaited study on the shark safety study finally came out. Let's set this up a bit. What was the study about and who was behind it, Sarah? Tell us.
Sure. This study was done by the Woods Hole Group with help from the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, the National Seashore, and the six Outer Cape towns. It cost $50,000. It was over 100 pages long, and they assigned a rating system for each type of shark mitigation strategy they looked at. So very in-depth.
Kristen, what were some of the potential solutions they were looking at here for managing shark risk?
So they were looking at 27 different technologies and other alternatives. And really what they concluded is that shark technologies such as drones, sonar buoys, electromagnetic and other repellents and camouflage aren't really quite ready to be put to use. They said there's little scientific research to back up those claims that you know, they could really reduce the problem with sharks, and that a lot of them have a spotty track record. The study really dismissed nets, contraception, and culling of sharks and seals as not being allowed under current law or being too expensive with really a limited chance of success.
So what did they point to? Sarah, why don't you tell us, what did they point to as something we should be looking at to mitigate this risk?
Sure, yeah. Pretty much in the end, the report says what a lot of Cape Codders have already known and suspected for a while, especially since last year's attack, that there's no guaranteed way to prevent another shark attack from happening, and that the best way to reduce your shark risk is to change the way you act in the water. For the towns, this will mean investing more in shark education efforts. Brian Carlstrom at the National Seashore mentioned yesterday they'll be looking at having more pop-up shark information booths next year at beaches. You know, we've looked into the Shark Ambassador program where there are people out on the beach who will kind of tell you how you can reduce your risk or not attract a shark. And, of course, towns say they'll be working to further improve cell phone service, which is still spotty at certain beaches. And, of course, just basics in the water. General knowledge is, they say, don't go in past your waist. Be aware of your risk even when you're in the water that's shallow, and don't swim near seals.
Kristen, the shark situation's really had an impact across the Outer Cape beaches. And even this year, the number of beach closings really escalated compared year over year.
Yeah, park officials said that the park closed beaches to swimming about a dozen times a season on average between 2013 and 2017. But that number grew to 27 closures last year and 43 this past summer. Attacks on seals at those public beaches have also become pretty common. And white sharks have actually attacked six humans in the past 7 years. Two of them were swimmers who suffered severe bite injuries. And there was a fatal attack, as we all know, on the bodyboarder Arthur Medici in Wellfleet last year. Plus, there was a bite on a paddleboarder in Wellfleet and an attack on two kayakers in Plymouth that didn't result in injuries.
So they spent $50,000 on this report that it's essentially right now recommending more education and changing human behavior. Sarah, tell us, there was a public meeting last night and at Nauset High School, and about 200 people came out, I think. And what was the response to this report? How are people taking this? This was a much anticipated report. I think a lot of people were hoping that it would provide more concrete solutions or point to more concrete solutions.
Yeah, definitely. The report was highly, highly anticipated, and it cost a good chunk of money. And it is extensive. But in the end, I think a lot of people were somewhat disappointed by what it said, since it basically reiterated what a lot of us already know and suspect. Last night's meeting, about 200 people came out, and a lot of people mentioned that they felt the report was more negative than positive, that it looked at a lot of different strategies and basically said no on them because of cost or because they were being judged on a 100% guarantee bar, which, of course, none of those technologies can provide. A lot of people asked last night why towns weren't more willing to just try some of the strategies, like using drones or spotter planes, to at least help with some of the fear. The towns say, of course, these methods aren't a guarantee, and that even if you might feel better seeing a plane over the water, it might not actually make you any safer. So they don't want to fake you out or anything like that.
At the same time, this was put together again by the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy and the Outer Cape towns, six Outer Cape towns, and the Cape Cod National Seashore. And these folks are saying that this is really not, this is really just the beginning of a discussion about solutions. This is kind of a baseline to work from.
Yeah, I think what we heard at the meeting yesterday was that this wasn't meant to be the be-all, end-all, final word on all these things. I think they may be looking into some pilot programs in the future, and they definitely are going to be trying to get more public involvement and input into what types of solutions they should be looking to implement.
For all that, it doesn't seem like the sharks situation has affected beach attendance much this year, Kristen.
No, it's we spoke to some officials at the National Seashore who said that data collected by lifeguards over the course of this year showed about average attendance at the beaches, that nearly about 865,000 people went to the park's beaches, ocean beaches, and about 80,000 people ventured into the water. So people still going out there, you know, they might maybe just aren't going quite as deep.
And Sarah, the state has set aside some money for towns to help respond to the shark concerns. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Governor Baker has earmarked $195,000 for next year's budget that could go to shark mitigation strategies. And so that's going to be discretionary for the town. But the towns say they are going to be using that to improve cell phone service, improve education, and possibly have more Stop the Bleed trainings and fund a couple more all-terrain vehicles.
That is WCAI's lead reporter, Sarah Mises-Tan. Sarah, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Kristen, stay with us here. I want to ask you about State Senator Vinny DiMacedo, who represents parts of Plymouth and Barnstable counties. He surprised many people by announcing his midterm retirement this week.
Yes, so Vinny DiMacedo has accepted a position at Bridgewater State University, and he said he's planning to vacate the Plymouth and Barnstable district seat in the coming weeks. There will be a special election held to fill that office, although the date hasn't been determined yet. DiMacedo did say his staff will remain in place until a successor is elected. And it's an interesting district. It comprises the towns of Bourne, Falmouth, and Sandwich in Barnstable County, and the towns of Kingston, Pembroke, and Plymouth in Plymouth County, so it's sort of a mix of on-Cape, off-Cape there. DiMacedo turned 54 on Wednesday, and he spent more than two decades in Beacon Hill in the House and the Senate. He was first elected to the House in 1998, and after serving eight terms, was elected to the Senate in 2014. He's also the ranking minority member of the Senate Ways and Means Committee.
Tell us about the job that he's moving on to take.
So he's taking the job as the Director of Regional Partnerships at Bridgewater State, and that comes with an annual salary of $99,000. And DiMacedo said that presented an opportunity that's sort of right up his alley. He said he's really enjoyed being a state senator and working in the legislature, but that job often takes him away from home on nights and weekends. He's hoping this new position will have more traditional hours and it will provide more time for him to spend with his wife, children, and grandchildren.
I had an opportunity to talk to DiMacedo this week, and he was emphasizing that the job right now as state senator requires him to be on the road sometimes 4 hours a day, and that he really is looking forward to not having to do that kind of commute. But also, he was really talking about his legacy and hoping that he's remembered as somebody who brought a lot of the spirit of collaboration to government and was able to represent people no matter what their party affiliation was, and really was a solutions kind of building in person there for the State House and for the Cape delegation. He says he's not really going to disappear from the Cape region, even though he'll be in Bridgewater, Kristen?
That's right. He's hoping that this new position will kind of give him a chance to expand Bridgewater's presence on Cape Cod. He said Bridgewater already has a campus here. He'd like to expand those opportunities for people on Cape Cod to get a four-year degree from Bridgewater down here.
Now, before he retires, he and State Senator Julian Sear have co-sponsored a bill that would give more power to a citizens advisory panel that looks at the decommissioning of Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. This was in the news this week. Tell us a little bit about this bill.
Yeah, so this is a proposed legislative tweak that was filed by the pair of senators. And what it would do is eliminate two slots on the Nuclear Decommissioning Citizens Advisory Panel that are currently reserved for representatives of the plant's owner. And it will add two slots for residents of Barnstable County. Sears said the idea is really to ensure that the Cape does have representation on the panel while ridding the committee of a major obstacle to get things done. This advisory panel was established by state legislation in 2016. It has 21 members, including residents and local officials, representatives of state agencies, and currently two representatives from Pilgrim's new owner, Holtec International. In addition to changing the makeup of the panel, the bill would make representatives from the state agency's non-voting members. And that's really important because they usually abstain from committee votes because they need to get approval from their respective agencies prior to voting. And a lot of times that can hold up votes from going through because the way the law is currently written, motions for recommendations from the advisory panel only pass if 11 members, which is a majority of the full committee, are in favor. By making those positions, the state positions, non-voting members, the hope is that more things can get done.
So this is a bit complicated about how this works, but again, the potential here is that it will give more of a voice and an impact to this watchdog committee. What are advocates who have been looking to close down Pilgrim and have been concerned about safety issues there, what are they saying about this bill?
Well, they're saying that this really needs to happen, that the makeup of the panel makes it impossible to get anywhere. And that statement was from Diane Turco, who's the president of the Cape Town Winders. She regularly attends these monthly advisory panel meetings, and she's really in support of the proposed changes. Mary Limpert, who's a director of a citizens group called Pilgrim's Watch, also provided written comments on the proposed legislation on behalf of that group. She supported eliminating the two plant representatives, saying that the interests of those who are employed by Pilgrim and not on its payroll are very different.
I want to ask you about one other story in the news this week, Kristen. Faith leaders and others in the community from around the region have denounced a defaced Israeli flag that was placed outside the Falmouth Jewish congregation, a very troubling incident that's had a lot of people upset, in part for what it says about the community.
That's true. And this happened last week, only hours after the holy Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur. Rabbi Elias Lieberman of the Falmouth Jewish Congregation said that the congregation had finished the observance of Yom Kippur on Wednesday evening, that sometime overnight or early in the morning, someone left the defaced flag. He said he believes the flag was initially spread out in the courtyard near the pavement by the main entrance. The wind then blew the flag into the bushes in the courtyard where he discovered it. He took it inside, photographed it, and contacted the Falmouth Police Department as well as the Anti-Defamation League of New England. Falmouth Police did respond and they started an investigation. However, video surveillance didn't really provide anything that was helpful to that investigation. Lieberman said that this is the first time in the nearly 30 years that he served as rabbi for the congregation that he felt like an act was directly aimed at his community as a message of hate. He said members of the congregation have expressed fear and concern following the incident. And this flag was spray painted in red with a swastika over the Star of David. And it was spray painted in a code 1488, which really is known as a general endorsement of white supremacy and its beliefs. In speaking with the Anti-Defamation League, our reporter learned that acts of hate against Jewish people in Jewish institutions in Massachusetts have hit all-time highs over the past 2 years. The monitoring of white supremacy activity in Massachusetts in the first 8 months of this year has actually more than doubled what the League saw in 2018.
I had a chance to speak to Rabbi Lieberman this week, and one of the things he pointed out is that he is members of his congregation there who went through the Holocaust, and to have a swastika directed at them is a very powerful thing, as you can probably appreciate. He also said that while the incident was deeply disturbing, he said it certainly didn't—he was trying to contextualize it, and he said, you know, we have to remember that it doesn't rise to the level of what some other communities, Jewish communities and other minority communities, have experienced over the past year, where lethal violence was directed at them. So he said, I think that having a perspective is an important piece of how we react to this kind of incident. That said, there was really strong reaction from other faith leaders around the area to this, Kristen.
Yes, local faith leaders are speaking out in support of the Jewish community. Reverend Nell Fields of the Wacoiet Congregational Church said that we can't allow this to become normalized behavior. She said the only way to stop this is to point it out, say that it's wrong, and say let's do better. Reverend Deborah Warner of the Church of the Messiah in Woods Hole also agreed. She said it's imperative to try to uphold the dignity of sisters and brothers in the Jewish community and she'll continue to do that in any way that she possibly can.
I think one other note on this was that the timing of this was particularly strong, coming on the last day of Yom Kippur and also following on an attack in Germany.
Yes, that's true. There was a deadly synagogue attack on Wednesday that killed two people in Germany. It also, this incident came before the day of the one-year anniversary of a white supremacist killing 11 people at a Pittsburgh synagogue, and that was the most single deadly attack on Jews in American history, in America. And close to home, there have been some incidents, too. An incident last week, someone vandalized parking spaces at Sandwich High School with sexual images and swastikas. Sandwich Police Chief Peter Wack said that is still under investigation, but it appears to have no connection with the incident at the synagogue. Only a week ago, there were reports of vandals leaving swastikas and sexual images on the docks near Megansett Yacht Club in North Falmouth.
Mm. This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. Joining us from the Cape Cod Times has been Kristen Young. Kristen, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining us now from the Vineyard Gazette is Noah Asmo. Good morning, Noah.
Good morning, Steve.
Noah, you've got a nice story this week about a literal barn raising on the island. And just like the metaphor would suggest, it was very much a community effort to make this happen.
Yes, it absolutely was. So just a little background, Flat Point Farm, which is in West Tisbury, experienced a devastating fire in last March. Not only did the fire raise the barn, but the other type of raise, R-A-Z-E, but it...
It demolished the barn, really. There's nothing left, yeah.
No, yeah, it was left, you know, and then it also took the lives of 90 animals that were inside the barn, including 22 sheep, goats, two cattle, and 50 chickens. So it was really a sad moment, but the community totally rallied in support after the fire happened. I mean, it was a mass mutual aid effort to get it out, but then also neighbors came together. Peter Rodegast, who he started drafting plans for the new facility. Others organized a GoFundMe campaign that I think actually was able to raise over $120,000. There was a fundraiser potluck, and so over the summer, people kind of got together to make sure that the Fisher family, which owns Flat Point Farm and has lived there for three generations, at least since 1939, was able to get the barn back up.
And tell us about the new barn now that they've put up. It was quite a barn raising, apparently.
Yeah, so it was really kind of it was kind of this really cool event. They brought an 8-man Amish crew from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, who have built many barns on the island, actually. But they work incredibly fast. They have expert skill. I think I was there at 10 or so on Monday they arrived, and then when I got there at about 1, they pretty much put up almost the entire frame. Sill work was totally done. By the next day they were doing siding. It was kind of like watching masters at their craft do this. And what was even one of the more special parts about it was that the Fisher family invited members of the public to come watch, people who had also helped with the effort to get the family back on their feet after the fire. And the family itself was there, and there were three generations of them, all of whom live at the farm now, but they were able to see, sort of history coming back to life.
And there was really a time pressure here to move this along to make sure that this got done at this point. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, any sort of construction project on the island has time constraints, especially because of the logistics of getting materials here. But this had particularly difficult ones. The Amish, one of their crew members, Ephraim, there was going to be a wedding for his son. Hunting season for them is about to begin soon. They don't really work all the way on the eastern seaboard in the winter. Most of the projects they do are going to be closer to Pennsylvania. And so if it didn't go up now, it was going to have to wait until spring. And I think the general sentiment was it pretty much had to. This family was relying on it. They needed it. And the Amish were able to make it happen.
And now for this family going into the winter, they've got the barn there, and the community really, as you say, rallied around to make this happen with the fundraising efforts behind it. The feeling now is that this has been kind of a success?
Yes, I definitely think so. And, it's an opportunity for new things. Not to say that the old barn wasn't wonderful, but I think the family thinks, that barn dates back 80 years. It had a lot of history and was state-of-the-art for the time. There were automatic waterers, but it was built as a dairy farm for dairy cows, and now it was being used for multiple purposes and multiple uses. And there were other things they wanted to change about it, too. They reoriented it so that they could use solar power in the future. They were able to sort of make it smaller but more contained and have a smaller hayloft, which were things that industry experts point to now for barns. So, I think it was an opportunity to have something new for the family, an opportunity that otherwise wouldn't have happened, even if it came out of a crisis.
Noah Asmo from the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us with that story this morning.
Well, thank you, Steve.
We're going to speak right now with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, the Conservation Law Foundation and the Wequosset Resort have reached a settlement in a lawsuit filed more than a year ago. We talked about this then on the program. The suit had to do with discharge impacting marine waters. Is that right?
That's right. The the Conservation Law Foundation had charged that both the Quasadin and the Witchmere Harbor Club, which is on Nantucket Sound, were contributing nitrogen pollution to the surrounding waters by allowing their sewage disposal systems to discharge effluent into the groundwater, which the Conservation Law Foundation claimed was then carried along hydraulically into Pleasant Bay and Nantucket Sound. The organization asserted that both of these resorts should have had federal National Pollution Discharge Elimination System permits, but both of the resorts denied that they had done anything improper. They both said their waste disposal systems conformed with local and state regulations, and they weren't polluting the marine waters. And this week it was announced that the Conservation Law Foundation and the Wequosset had settled their suit without admitting to any of the allegations, and in fact expressly denying them. The Wequosset agreed to resolve the situation by upgrading its wastewater treatment plant to further reduce nitrogen outflow and to set up a system to monitor the treatment process. And they also agreed to increase the duration of treatment during high flow periods, basically the summer season, in order to basically add a heightened level of treatment to keep the nitrogen discharge levels low.
Another thing that they've done here is to agree to financially contribute to some of the environmental projects that are ongoing around the region. I thought this is interesting.
Yeah, that was another aspect of the settlement, that the Inn agreed to make a financial contribution to an environmental project in Pleasant Bay, and they chose to make a contribution to the Friends of Pleasant Bay's efforts to purchase Sipson's Island. The amount of the payment was not disclosed, but both parties said that this will help ultimately benefit Pleasant Bay and the surrounding communities by preserving the property on the island and not allowing it to be developed. Now, the Inn has agreed to complete those upgrades and make that financial payment by December 2020. And we're still waiting for information on the Witchmere Harbor Club lawsuit that the Law Foundation filed at the same time. They were scheduled to have a hearing in Boston yesterday, and we haven't heard what the results of that hearing are, but we'll be keeping tabs on that, and if there's news, we'll report it next week.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hey, Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
We're going to speak right now with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, let me ask you, start off anyway, just about the storm that passed through. How did the island fare here?
The island fared apparently much better than the Cape and the rest of the state did. It was the second powerful coastal storm in a week to hit Nantucket, but all it really did was cancel boat and plane service all day yesterday. No power outages were reported, only some downed tree limbs and branches across the island, no other real damage. The winds blew pretty much from late Wednesday night into yesterday night, about 35 to 40 miles an hour out of the southwest, with a gust of about 60 reported at Nantucket Memorial Airport. The boats are running again today. Power was on all day yesterday. Not as powerful or as impactful as last week's storm, which canceled boat and plane service for 2 days. Also knocked out power for about 2 or 3 hours to 1,700 people on Thursday, and damaged the floating docks at the town pier, which are going to be removed later this month for repair.
Josh, I want to ask you about a story in this week's paper about paid parking coming to downtown Nantucket next summer. Tell us about this and what its impact could be.
Well, you know, looking for a parking spot on Nantucket downtown in the summertime has always been a frustrating and a challenging endeavor. Usually involves circling around Main Street several times until a space opens up, and then if you overstay your welcome in any of those spots, getting a parking ticket. But now town officials are looking to run a pilot program starting in the summer for paid parking. Next summer, motorists can expect to pay through an app on their phone for by-the-minute parking in the downtown core district. And the intent here is to do a couple of things. It's to reduce the traffic congestion into and around town from those vehicles constantly circling, to encourage other forms of transportation to get downtown, and to discourage long-term parking by people who work downtown who move their vehicles from space to space all day, to free up those spaces for shoppers, for visitors, for people who have actually business downtown. They're looking to use this app system instead of kiosks. Drivers would pull into a space, log on to the app on their phone, plug into their location and the license plate number and pay for however much time they wanted to stay there. If people didn't have cell phones or didn't have the app, there might be a kiosk or two located around town in different businesses, maybe visitor services, town officials say, where they could take care of their parking. It's not a universal support for this. There are some critics who say they don't think it's going to do much at all to take care of the parking shortage. It's not creating any more spaces. And they say that people will be willing to pay whatever it is the town's charging, and they haven't decided that yet for those spots. And the problem of still trying to find a space is not going to change until more parking is actually added to the downtown area.
This is part of an overall effort to sort of reevaluate the parking in downtown on the island there. And this isn't a kind of the finished solution either, is what they're saying.
They are. This is a project that's been going on for quite some time and will probably continue. It's part of the town's strategic plan to address parking. So a couple studies recently have actually said that parking in legal spaces on Nantucket actually exceeds 100% at times, which means people are not only filling every single legal space downtown, but parking on yellow lines and parking in no parking spaces. Real estate is at a premium. There isn't really too many places to do anything. So they're looking at as many different alternatives as they can. They've tried valet parking. There's been debate for more than a decade about building a parking garage that's had both its supporters and its detractors over the years, but right now it seems to be the one solution that may be gaining a little traction given as much traffic and as much many parking dilemmas that there have been the last couple of years.
And this would represent a significant technological advancement, right? Right now, parking is still sort of regulated by chalking tires on the island.
Right now, parking is regulated by chalking tires. There have been attempts and pilot programs to do a little more license plate scanning and efforts like that. But right now, it's chalking tires, and it's mostly summer special police officers monitoring parking in the downtown area on an hourly basis or on a half-hour basis and then handing out tickets. This would be a very large leap technologically.
Now, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, I'm glad to hear that the storm did not hit the island that hard. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on the Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining us now on the phone from the Provincetown Independent is Ed Miller. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve.
Ed, oyster farming is on the rise in Provincetown. This is quite an upbeat story from your reporter, Paul Benson, inasmuch as it suggests an opportunity for people working in aquaculture in Provincetown.
That's right, Steve. Of course, this weekend, as most people I think know, is Wellfleet Oyster Fest weekend. And Wellfleet is most oysters, but it's not the only town on the Cape that produces oysters. And oyster farming has become a major growth industry in Provincetown. Just 10 years ago, there was only one person doing it. Now there are nine. And the shellfish constable in Provincetown, Steve Wisbauer, has really been working hard to increase the amount of area in the harbor that is available for growing shellfish. The town has really gotten behind it in a big way. So there are grants available now. There's no waiting list for people who want to get into this work. And that's pretty unusual for aquaculture out here.
There's been a history of aquaculture in Provincetown, but it hasn't always been oysters.
Well, that's right. 30 years or so ago, quahogs were grown in the tidal flats of the West End. But then there was kind of a disaster. A mysterious parasite, Wisbauer says, wiped them out in the early 1990s. And only one person, Alex Brown, continued farming in those flats after that. But he switched from quahogs to oysters and kept working his grant out there on a small scale. Just in the last few years, it's really picked up in a big way. They added, the town, in collaboration with Truro, added a deep water area off of Beach Point. And the local farmers have been experimenting with different methods, including starting out the small seed in the deep water area and then moving it when it gets a little bit bigger, to the flats. It's very intensive work, and it was interesting. Yesterday we had an editorial staff meeting, and one of the people said, boy, I read that story, and it really made me think I would never want to be growing oysters. That just sounds too hard. And it's funny because Paul, who wrote the story, said, you know, I talked to those people and wrote that story, and it really made me want to do it. It's definitely a young person's job. It's very physically demanding. The hours are tough, and you don't get much of a payout for the first 3 years or so. You don't make any money. But
is farming. You're kind of at the mercy of the elements, and your crop, you have to be out there when the tides are low. You're sort of tied into the rhythm of nature in order to work your crop.
Exactly. You can only work for about 4 hours at a time at low tide, and some days, the low tide is at 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. And so you're out there at strange hours doing this physical work. But as one of the oyster farmers said, it's a great place to have an office.
I thought the numbers that are cited in your article are informative here, that Provincetown this year is landing about, what, a quarter of a million oysters?
That's right. This year, 250,000 compared to Wellfleet bringing in 9 to 10 million. But that 250,000 has increased, I think, fourfold or tenfold in the last 4 years.
But that's still not enough to even to furnish Provincetown's need for oysters, apparently.
No. Apparently that fulfills about 10% of the demand in Provincetown alone. So it's still a little unusual to find a Provincetown oyster on the menu. But with another 100 acres of flats that are in process of getting approved for aquaculture, that could really change over the next few years.
Is there a sense that there's a demand for when those 100 acres become available, that people will be there to start farming them?
Well, I think so. In other towns that have an aquaculture industry, there's a waiting list for grants. So there are people who want to do this work, and they need to come. And, you have to have some money to put into it because it costs for equipment, and you have to be able to support yourself in some other way for the first few years. But it's a way to have your own business here and be independent, work outdoors, and if you're successful, to make a decent living.
And as you mentioned, Wellfleet Oyster Fest is happening this weekend, expected to draw about 20,000 people to that event.
That's right, yeah. And people will come and see the fun part of it, the shuckers and the eaters. but they should check out our story on ProvincetownIndependent.org to see what some of the details are behind the work that goes into it is really prodigious.
Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent. Ed, thanks for joining us this morning.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Steve.
We're going to speak now with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve.
George, let me start off by asking you about the storm that passed through. What's the sense of what its impact was on the island?
A lot of power outages, a lot of downed trees, the wires down, arcing wires, that type of thing. Certainly some erosion, and there was street flooding, in some of the typical spots. I think people are relieved that it was a 24-hour storm rather than the one that was relentless the week before. But having no ferry service for 3-plus days over the span of 7 days is never a good thing. It made for some a chaotic Saturday, and this morning was pretty busy on the ferries as well. So,
and you take the ferry to work?
I do, on both occasions was trapped on the mainland side, but still working remotely. we love technology these days that allows us to do that. And I'm grateful for the staff here that was able to get out and get a lot of great pictures and get the news to folks and get it to me so I could get it on our website.
A Tisbury school crossing guard who had been taken off duty and had his personal firearms confiscated has been reinstated. This had to do with some alleged threats he had made that had been overheard. It's a story that really seemed to energize the island community. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is Stephen Nichols, longtime crossing guard and prior to that a Tisbury police officer for years. And on a September day, he was at Linda Jean's in Oak Bluffs and he was having a conversation. He was concerned that the school resource officer, as he put it, being a veteran, was leaving his post and going to a local store. And, you know, he raised that under the specter of what we've all come to be concerned about, and that's school shootings. And he said something to the effect of someone could go in and shoot up the school. He says that was construed by someone at Linda Jean's as being a threat to the school by him. And 2 days later, it was reported to the Tisbury police that what he had said. They went to speak to him. The police chief was involved, and another officer went to speak to Nichols. They actually went while he was out doing his crossing guard duties and said they would like to, you know, take him away from that area and speak to him about what happened. They took him to his house.
They did this while he was on the job. They came in.
While he was on the job,
yeah.
Yes. And so they went to his house, and they ended up relieving him of his crossing guard duties and taking away his firearms. And so we had just found out about that late last week. The story was posted on Friday after Rich Salzberg got a lot of the details and an interview with Mr. Nichols, who provided a lot of those details. We asked Tisbury police to comment. They wouldn't comment. We asked them for the police reports. They still haven't provided those. They say that they're protected under the personnel exemption because Mr. Nichols worked for the town. And so this is mostly Mr. Nichols' account of what happened, though he was backed up by the person who he was speaking with at that restaurant in Oak Bluffs, who said he was merely talking about the school resource officer leaving. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he does have sort of a misunderstanding of what a school resource officer is. They're not armed guards, security guards, to be at the school constantly. They're there for a presence, more of a community policing type thing. And so that's a point that's come out during this. But I have to say, the story was posted on Friday, and we put it on our Facebook page, and it was an amazing reaction, both on the island and in the state and nationally. This story went everywhere. And gun rights activists were concerned about the guns being removed from him and his license to carry being revoked. But others were just concerned that this 84-year-old guy who had never posed any threat before suddenly was removed from his job. And by Monday morning, which was a holiday, town officials had gotten together and brought Nichols in and said, we're going to put you back on the job on Tuesday morning. So he has been reinstated as a crossing guard at this point. His guns have not yet been returned, and his attorney is considering still filing about the whole gun issue in the courts for him to get his license to carry back. Mm. So the story has a lot of different threads to it, but also just amazing public outcry on this one that forced the town to get him back on the job. And with the post on our website, there are pictures of him back on the job. And people, we had a couple of people there, and everyone who passed by either honked their horns or flashed their lights or were calling out the window to him. He's obviously well-liked by parents and the children. It helps that he likes to pass out lifesavers to the kids as they're walking by. I'm sure they enjoy that. But he's a, you know, he's a gregarious guy. He, you know, and he, and this was important to him, I should note as well, because his wife had just died a short time ago. So this is really his connection to people on a daily basis, and that's why he loves to do this.
That is George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve. Have a good weekend.
You too. The Army Corps of Engineers recently released a report that recommends replacement of both the Bourne and Sagamore bridges. This morning, we got news that the Army Corps could divest ownership of the bridge of the bridges, both of them, to the state. WCAI Sam Houghton joins us now. Good morning, Sam.
Morning, Steve.
Sam, why is this coming about now?
Yeah, when you think about the Army Corps, you don't necessarily think of bridges across the country. They don't really maintain a whole lot of them, at least big ones like the Bourne and Sagamore bridges. So the news here is that Senators Ed Markey and Elizabeth Warren, they sent a letter to the Corps yesterday, really pressuring them to fund the new bridges. And the idea of this transfer ownership appeared in that letter. Congressman Bill Keating was also on that letter, and I spoke with him this morning. He says they've been discussing this divestment idea for some time now.
So what are our federal legislators saying? Because you can imagine that some people might have concerns that, here's an opportunity to sort of delay the whole replacement plan one more time.
Right. You're right. Keating told me that turning the bridges over to the state could actually give the state more flexibility. There's already been a lot of discussions about lining up state roads with these new bridges. It's going to have to be realigned a little bit. The state owns the roads, and the Army Corps owns the bridges, so you could see some potential problems there. Either way, Keating says the transfer really shouldn't be any kind of roadblock for the new bridges. He and the senators are also saying that transferring the bridges to the state would take away some responsibilities from the Army Corps, which, you know, they have projects across the country that have a pretty substantial workload.
These new bridges are expected to cost, I think, over $1 billion. Do we get a sense of how they'll be funded?
Yeah. So Keating, we talked a little bit about that this morning. He says the bridges need to be built as soon as possible, which means getting them design work going as quickly as possible. He's hoping that the new bridges aren't too, or he says they're not too far in the distance. He says construction could start by 2025. It seems like the Corps is on board with that as well. The Sagamore Bridge has some major renovation work that would have to be done in 2025. And I don't think, you know, no one wants to deal with that traffic, you know, situation when they do the renovation work. As for the actual funding, that was my takeaway from this letter that Keating, Warren, and Markey sent to the Corps. They say to find funding anywhere possible in its next round of funding for these new bridges.
So they are pushing hard on this. The report came out a couple of weeks back from the Army Corps of Engineers, and it was a draft report, and they're taking public comment right now on it, but it did recommend replacing both bridges. Remind us what it is that they're really proposing here.
Yeah, my takeaway was kind of surprising to me is they're calling for 6 lanes for each bridge, 3 in each direction. They're also calling for bike paths and sidewalks and kind of a big median in between the opposite lanes of traffic. There's also chances they could take some private land around the Bourne Rotary, which came up at a meeting this week, which I think we talked about earlier in the show. So some potential big changes for the Bourne Rotary and the Sagamore area as well.
And again, this all has to do with these several different agencies working together because the state doesn't own the bridges, but it has all the highways that connect and plug into the bridges. And so you're trying to get these big entities to move together kind of in lockstep to make this happen.
Yeah, and that actually came up in the letter that these senators and Markey wrote that saying that, you know, this could really bring those together, make it easier, give the state more flexibility to do this project and, you know, for the long road ahead as well into the future, that will give them some more flexibility.
It's WCAI's Sam Houghton. Sam, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thanks, Steve.
That is what's been happening around the Cape and Islands this week. I want to thank my guests. We spoke with Sarah Mises-Tan this morning, Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times, Noah Asimo from the Vineyard Gazette. We checked in with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.